Good morning, early birds. You've caught the worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. The Blackfeet Nation closes off the eastern entrance to Glacier National Park, remote work during the pandemic, and the next installment of our series on the Little Shell Tribe. It's Monday, June 29th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The Bighorn County Health Department announced Friday residents are required to wear face coverings or masks outside their homes. Rachel Kramer reports.
Health officials say the order is in response to a sudden rise of COVID-19 cases in the county. At least 34 people in Bighorn are sick with the disease. Children younger than 2 are not required to wear face masks. Neither are people working outside or recreating as long as they're able to maintain 6 feet of distance. Other exceptions include people who cannot wear a mask due to health or safety concerns and have a note from their doctor or employer. Cloth masks can be picked up free of charge at the Bighorn County Public Health Department in Hardin. The county will also have volunteers distributing masks at local events. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Police in northwestern Montana say a man was arrested on a felony criminal mischief charge after he pulled down a Ten Commandments monument using a chain and a pickup truck. NBC Montana reports the 30-year-old Columbia Falls man reportedly wrapped a chain around the religious monument on the Flathead County Courthouse grounds on Saturday. Police say he then attached the chain to his truck and pulled the monument into the street. A suspect was later arrested after police located the truck allegedly used in the act. Police say they do not know why the suspect allegedly took down the monument. A U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist doing fieldwork in southwest Montana survived a grizzly bear attack Wednesday, Kayla DeRoche reports.
According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the biologist was working on a sage-grouse monitoring project in Red Rock Lakes National Wildlife Refuge when they noticed 2 bears nearby, and one of them charged. The federal agency says the biologist used bear spray until the attacking bear backed off and ran away with the other bear. Wildlife Service spokesperson Joseph Wallach says the biologist sustained non-life-threatening bites from the attack.
The biologist was able to make contact with other U.S. Fish and Wildlife staff.
He says the biologist was transported to a hospital in nearby Rexburg, Idaho, and was released later that afternoon. According to a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service press release, the biologist's report suggests the bears may have been siblings around 3 years old. Says Wallach declined to share the identity of the biologist and says an investigation is ongoing. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says 7 people have been injured by bears so far this year in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
The Blackfeet Nation wrote in a resolution Thursday it will close off-road access to Glacier National Park's east entrances for the remainder of the tourism season. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports tribal leaders made the decision because of the growing number of COVID-19 cases in the state.
The Blackfeet Tribal Business Council issued a resolution saying it will close roads leading from state and federal highways to park entrances, including Two Medicine, Chief Mountain, Going to the Sun, Cutbank Creek, and many Glacier Roads. Glacier National Park spokesperson Jenna Kersman says park leadership is still digesting the decision, but says the east entrances will likely remain closed for the season. That could mean operations on Going to the Sun Road will look different.
We're taking into consideration things like having one entrance point. If you just enter from the west entrance and exit from the west entrance, what would that look like?
Kersman adds that the park is also considering where visitors could turn around and how many people could be on the road at once. Chairman of the Tribal Business Council, Tim Davis, says closing the road will hit the $110 million a year tourism industry in Glacier County, which encompasses the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. But Davis says the economy is not the only concern.
We're not, again, doing this based on economics. It was based on science and health.
Davis says the tribe received more than $30 million in federal relief funding and is still deciding how to spend that money. He says the council will consider economic relief for businesses and employees who are out of work due to the closure of the park gates. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
The state's top campaign rules enforcer found the Montana Republican Party and two other groups violated state law. Kevin Trevlin reports the violations came in a successful attempt to place the Green Party on this year's primary ballot.
State Commissioner of Political Practices Jeff Mangan wrote in his Thursday decision that the Montana GOP failed to accurately report the date and distribution of a $100,000 contribution to Texas-based firm Advanced Micro Targeting. The company used the money to fund signature gathering in January and February to qualify Green Party candidates for this year's primary election. The Montana Green Party has rejected involvement in the process and doesn't endorse candidates running under their banner in this election cycle. The Montana Democratic Party filed the March complaint that spurred Mangan's findings. Executive Director Sandy Lucky says the action was taken in support of transparency.
Montana voters have a right to fair and honest information so that they can make the best decisions for themselves. It's about defending the integrity of our elections from fraudulent efforts like this one that was funded by the Montana Republican Party.
Some political observers believe the appearance of Green Party candidates on the ballot could draw votes from Democrats. The state GOP acknowledged making the $100,000 payment, but not before the Green Party qualified for this year's primary ballot. In a statement, Montana Republican Party Executive Director Spencer Merwin disagreed with Mangan's findings and wrote that all of the party's campaign finance disclosures followed the law. The Montana Republican Party made the contribution through a group called Montanans for Conservation, which initially registered as an independent committee in January. Mangan found the group violated campaign finance law by failing to register as a minor party qualification committee in time, and that a third related group failed to report finance records under the required time frame. In 2019, lawmakers passed minor party qualification committee regulations after another successful signature gathering effort by the same Texas-based company to qualify the Green Party for the 2018 ballot. A Montana Democratic Party lawsuit resulted in a judge disqualifying the Green Party from the 2018 cycle. State Democrats again filed a lawsuit June 1st seeking to remove Green Party candidates from the 2020 general election ballot. Kevin Trevlin, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Kevin Trevlin is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America Statehouse reporter. For years, economic developers have touted the possibilities for people to live in Montana and work for companies that aren't here. The COVID-19 shutdown has, in some ways, offered proof of that concept. Charles Bolte reports for our series looking at lasting ways Montana is adapting during the pandemic. It's funded in part by the Solutions Journalism Network.
Bob McCauley and his wife live in a lush, shady patch of the Mission Valley just north of St. Ignatius, population 830. Their little spread is filled with birdsong. The dramatic Mission Mountains rise a few miles to the east.
Real beautiful location. I hurry up to get home.
McCauley and his wife moved here over 20 years ago. Like a lot of people, the McCauleys had to handle at least parts of their jobs and also their son's schoolwork from home when the pandemic hit. And that was tougher in St. Ignatius than it was in other places.
The phone connection for our internet was not very good, and this, we're being told, is way more reliable.
McCauley's referring to the fiber optic cable that's being installed at his house.
We're hoping this will solve our internet problem and, you know, have better connection here and faster speed.
A study published by researchers at the National Bureau of Economic Research and MIT says that one-third of the nation's employed workforce shifted to working from home in early April. In Montana, some, like Congressman and Republican candidate for Governor Greg Gianforte, are calling the work-from-home movement a silver lining of the pandemic. He's been promoting the idea as a politician since at least 2015. Ann Booth sees the value in that line of thinking.
More people are understanding that you can get a lot done in a day working by yourself without interruptions. You're more productive.
That's Booth on Zoom. She's an economic developer in Montana who grew up in and works from tiny Malta in Phillips County. Booth has worked in economic development for about 30 years. She heads up a volunteer working group under the Montana Economic Developers Association. The group launched 3 years ago and seeks ways to advance remote work in Montana. That's especially important for Montana's rural towns, she says.
The common goals are to increase local employment opportunities, to increase the median wage for residents. We want the brain gain and not the brain drain.
Booth's team held workshops and applied for grants. getting funds to do more has been a roadblock. But the sell is a little easier now.
And now with the pandemic, it's just all of a sudden that the mystery of working remote has been removed.
Prior to COVID, Booth worked with the state's Department of Labor and Industry on a toolkit to help employers and employees understand the ins and outs of remote work. The department's deputy commissioner, Kathleen O'Leary, says her office had to figure going remote along with the rest of the state. And now a lot more Montanans are paying attention to the work she did with Booth and others to promote working from home. Here's O'Leary.
I think what COVID has provided is an opportunity for those people and those employers who may not have tried it to look at what this looks like long term.
The appeal of that is one thing, but what about what Bob McCauley experienced? What about shaky internet connections in a huge, not terribly populated state? Booth says rural internet connection gets a bad rep. Sure, there are some connectivity gaps across the state, which still ranks dead last in the U.S. for broadband access on broadbandnow.com. But Booth points out that schools and libraries are well served and many rural places do have good internet. A big push to expand broadband is led by local providers like the ones Jeff Feiss represents. Here's Feiss on Zoom.
I'm the general manager of the Montana Telecommunications Association. I represent rural, locally owned telecommunications providers who serve roughly 70% of the state's landmass and probably 30% of the consumers.
MTA represents about a dozen telecom companies. In the last several years, they've been installing fiber optic cable across the state to upgrade the copper infrastructure. That work mostly prepared them when offices shut down and forced workers home. CEOs I talked to with Blackfoot Communications, Three Rivers, and Range have all said they've seen COVID-induced upticks in new users and upgraded connections. They, along with Jeff Feiss, also say their networks are handling increased bandwidth demand just fine. Here's Feiss again.
Massive numbers of people were shifted from the office to home, and generally speaking, were able to carry on their business as usual.
A spokesperson at the Research and Analysis Bureau at the Montana Department of Labor and Industry says there isn't solid state-level data indicating how many people are working from home or how many people are moving to the state and bringing a job with them. But Jeff Feiss says the last few months have provided proof that a lot of Montana can continue to work from home.
COVID turned the theory into reality in a big way, suddenly.
For Yellowstone Public Radio News and the Solutions Journalism Network, I'm Charles Bolte.
Roughly 6 months ago, the federal government officially recognized the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians as a sovereign nation. It was national news then, but what does it mean now for members and descendants of Little Shell? Nine students from the University of Montana School of Journalism spent a semester reporting on the impact of recognition on what has long been considered Montana's landless tribe. This story is part of the student-produced series Project Little Shell.
I'm Stephanie Maltrich. Growing up, Katrina Campbell of Bonner, Montana, didn't have much connection to her native heritage.
We had never really talked about being Little Shell before. We'd never said, like, we are Little Shell.
In late December 2019, after more than 130 years of trying, the tribe received federal recognition. Facebook groups popped up and others became a lot more active. Members and descendants of the tribe wanted to connect with each other. Campbell, who's 29, is a member of the Facebook group Unity in Little Shell, which has more than 1,300 members. People post photos of relatives and ancestors daily, sometimes reaching out for help as they figure out their lineage. In January, Campbell took notice when someone posted the row cloud roll.
My grandpa and great-grandmother were on it, and that's when I really started diving into the genealogical aspect of it.
The row cloud roll of landless Indians in Montana, compiled by Dr. Row Cloud in 1938, was a list of names of people who were associated with several tribes, but remained unenrolled. Today, the list helps people trace their history and eligibility for enrollment with Little Shell. Facebook helped Campbell use the row cloud roll to expand her research. Now she's compiling all of the information on a site called WikiTree, a free project helping people draw their own family trees.
diving into that past and seeing everyone else kind of interested in their past made me want to connect with other living members rather than just thinking about my dead ancestors.
It's a Saturday morning on Leap Day at Travelers Rest State Park in Lolo. Chris Latray, a writer and bookseller, is presenting on the history of his tribe for the Winter Storytelling Series. Like Campbell, Latray didn't know about his Little Shell heritage growing up. He's currently putting the finishing touches on a book he's writing, Becoming Little Shell. His research has taken him around the state to document his family and tribe's history.
I would do events, and I would talk about being Little Shell, and then inevitably I'd be contacted by people saying, oh, I'm a Latray too, or oh, I'm Little Shell too. So that's been interesting, just kind of tying those pieces together.
Latray wants to connect with other Little Shell in Missoula. He even posted about his event on the Facebook group, encouraging members to attend.
There's a couple of us through one of the Little Shell Facebook groups. We're talking about how do we come to know more of us who live in Missoula? Because there's a lot of us here that I don't even know about.
During his talk, Latray asked Little Shell members to stand up. A handful of people in the crowd did. With 114 members in Missoula, Latray had hoped for a better turnout. Latray hopes the initial excitement doesn't disappear like a New Year's resolution in February.
There was always these whispers that, you know, maybe we were Native, maybe we were this, maybe we were that.
That's Valerie Vies. She was at Latray's talk. She's an artist and member of the Little Shell tribe, and she's new to Missoula. As a child, Vies didn't know her dad. She met him when her brother was in the hospital following a car accident.
I walked into the room, and I saw a man standing there, and I knew he was my dad. So that's where my journey began as to finding out, you know, who we were and what this all meant to me. But before I could do any of that, I had to fill out a genealogy chart.
It was then when she started to put two and two together, and she found herself going down a rabbit hole to research and learn about her native heritage.
And, you know, back then we didn't have the internet. It wasn't like I could, you know, Google search anything. So I started writing letters. And I got thinking, well, I'm going to see if I belong to a tribe. Back came the letter, said, you are an enrolled member of the Little Shell tribe of Chippewa Indians of Montana. And I was like, whoa, you know, so this really is true. This really is true.
V says one of the most important things in unearthing her heritage, lineage, and history were finding people who ended up being mentors. They helped her learn how she fit in and what being Little Shell meant to her.
When I found out, you know, that I was part of the Little Shell tribe, like, what does this all mean to me? You know, where do I fit in? I mean, the mentoring helped me feel like I belonged there.
Federal recognition hasn't changed much for Vies, who's 62. She's been enrolled for decades. Vies understands everyone has different reasons for wanting to enroll in the tribe, from housing to medical benefits. She recognizes many people have needs. For her, it was about personal identity.
I just did it because I didn't know who in the heck I was and wanted to find out who I was and where I fit into it.
Back in her home outside of Missoula, Campbell scrolls through her phone looking at the family tree she's created online. She sees her work as important because she wants to connect with Little Shell people living today.
When the federal recognition came, I was already in a position to recognize this is an opportunity for me to be able to build a community that I've never had in this area.
Campbell feels it's necessary to earn her spot instead of claiming it. To do that, she plans to use her skills to help the tribe's present and future through her research.
So we have to pool together and share our knowledge so that we can all know about our history.
In Missoula, I'm Stephanie Maltrich.
After the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians gained federal recognition 6 months ago, students from the University of Montana School of Journalism talked at length with tribal members about what that means to them. Here's UM student Victor Ivaez.
And I recently went on a drive with Iku Beck. She is currently enrolled Blackfeet, but is also Métis, and plans on enrolling into the newly federally recognized Little Shell Tribe. We drove from Missoula to East Glacier, listening to the funky local radio stations along the way, like Browning's Thunder Radio. She enjoys visiting her grandma, aunt, and the towns her family has been a part of for generations.
I really like the drive between Missoula and up north for a number of different reasons. I've been on it so many times in my life that it feels very familiar. I like it because often I get to go alone, by myself, thinking about things and looking out at land that a lot of stories that I grew up hearing are based on. And so many of my experiences happen throughout the land that, like, comes from Missoula to Augusta to Shoto to Browning. to East Glacier and St. Mary's. You can just turn up music and move your body or do whatever the heck you want. And it feels very freeing. I love looking out at the prairies with the blue sky and just be out there and it's still. And the prairies are like an ocean, but less scary because you get to like see out in every direction. You get really great sunsets and sunrises, and storms pass through really fast, and you can, you know, navigate via the stars. And they move like waves based on how windy it is and the grass moving. There's usually buttes and different hills along the way. And then there's always like a lot of little creatures that you can't see. And during the winter, it's white and barren and flat. And you can see the mountains in the distance. The mountains, I don't know, are very overwhelming to me because that's where the gods live. To me, it looks like a place where any kind of higher being like touches earth. Like that's where they roam. I feel like that's what it looks like. And that's really overwhelming to me. But it's beautiful. And you just can't, like, what did I get to deserve this, is what I think when I look at the mountains. Sometimes I just feel powerfully connected. It's hard to put that in words. Connection that you have when you and something ancestral are colliding. I don't know how to describe it, but it feels really good. Like, I had this friend that used to say that deja vu, like when you felt deja vu, it meant that you were in the right place at the right time and the world was leading you in the right way. And that's how I feel when I have like a moment of ancestral, quote unquote, ancestral connection or whatever, where I feel like there's something in me that's connecting with someone who once lived here long ago. It's a very special moment.
You've been listening to Iku Beck, a future member of the Little Shell Tribe. I'm Victor Ives.
This story is part of a series about the Little Shell Tribe produced by the Native News Honors Project at the University of Montana School of Journalism. It's funded in part by the Greater Montana Foundation. Listen for more stories tied to Little Shell recognition this summer. And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.